The House Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to open the public hearing, House Bill 2903. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2903 reduces the minimum time from 2 weeks to 72 hours before an employee's first day of employment that the employer is required to notify in the written employment offer that an arbitration agreement or a non-competition agreement is required as a condition for employment.
And we have Senator Frank Morris, please. Senator, if you'd like to come on up. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Frank Morris, representing District 8 in the Senate. And I appreciate your advancing this to the top of the calendar, Mr. Chair. I was asked to review this bill and wanted to testify in favor of this change. And if I may, Mr. Chair, put my former hat on, not my legislative hat on, and the chair and I have a previous business relationship.
Yes, we do.
In a company that I served as the president. But I can I can't imagine any circumstance. Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair.
Good morning, Senator.
May I testify on behalf of your bill?
Sure, I'll come down after you.
Okay, thank you. I can imagine no circumstance as an employer or as an employee where the interests of either would be well served by waiting 2 weeks. Once you've done the search, you've interviewed, you've narrowed your list of candidates down, and you've selected a candidate for a very important position, by the way, if you're going to be implementing a non-competition agreement. Why you would want to wait 2 weeks to employ that person, particularly in the environment that we find ourselves in today. So I come to speak from a business experience in favor of this bill. I believe that 72 hours is essentially the time that it takes to clear an employee through all your processes once you have decided to make that employment offer. So, Mr. Chair, committee members, I think this is a good piece of legislation and would encourage your moving this forward.
Thank you, Senator. Representative? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you, Senator, for coming over and testifying based on your experience. Colleagues, this bill, today there is probably 250,000 unemployed Oregonians. And I think that our focus should be in this building today. Everything that we're looking at is how do we help those people find jobs. And part of that is how do we help employers get those people to work as fast as possible. This bill before us today, I think the senator said it well, is basically going to take a 2 week wait from somebody who wants to go to work today down to a 3 day wait for somebody who wants to go to work today. So I would just encourage you to listen to whatever testimony we have today, and if there's some issues that come up that we need to fix to make this bill work, we just need to find a way to get people to work. And waiting 2 weeks in any environment, especially in today's environment, before I can go get a job when somebody has a job waiting for me and I'm ready to go to work, is really not good policy. So I would encourage your support for House Bill 2903.
Thank you. I think it has merit as well. And I guess the question is, what kind of employer would just spring this on a potential employee in the first place? And what kind of environment would that make for a potential employee? I'd imagine when you're interviewing for someone, we'll use Morris Brothers, this is a fairly large corporation, and they really need people with incredibly high-level technical skills. And I'm sure frequently do nationwide searches to fill positions. I can't imagine why they would spring this on an employee after they agreed to go work there. That's the only question I have, and if you want to respond to that, I think it has merit. I support the bill. I'm ready to vote for it myself, but if you just want to share any thoughts on that direction at all. other than agreeing with me.
Mr. Chair, I heard testimony on this last session and couldn't figure out where that would come.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't testimony of abuse in at that point in time, and what has happened since this law was passed is it caught up a lot of people that didn't even know it was coming, and you know, especially in today's environment, even in 2 years ago in that environment, I as an employee have the option to say yes or no. And as an employer, I have the option to say yes or no. And with 72 hours, I think that's a reasonable amount of time for those things to be put out on the table and people to take a look at and say, okay, yes or no, versus 2 weeks.
Mr. Chair, members, I think first we need to remember that if we're in a position of offering a non-competition agreement to a prospective employee, that is a position that is a fairly significant position, one that is not just kind of a routine hiring. In my experience, it was something that was somewhat exceptional. And if it is in fact sprung on the employee after the employee comes to work, it's void. By the proposed language change. In either case, it would be void. So there is advance notice required. That would be a proposed 72 hours, which allows the employee, prospective employee, to make a decision, well, will I accept this position with a non-competition agreement? And it's pre-employment, not post-employment. And I think that's very important. I personally believe that if you hire someone in a very important position and then you spring a non-competition agreement upon them after they've made a commitment to uproot, possibly move long distances, make major changes in their lives, and all of a sudden there's a condition that they didn't anticipate, that's not fair. But I believe that this bill would in fact be fair, and it would allow for a much shorter time to put somebody into a position than current law.
Thank you. Representative Edwards, then Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking for a clarification from you or anybody here that was here last session. I'm trying to remember, we did something in 2007 with regard to non-competition agreements, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it was that we did.
I'm going to go to the smartest person in the room.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, yes, House Bill 248 was the bill that was, and the main provision of that established that the arbitration and non-compete agreements were voidable unless the agreement was made, was in the written offer from the two-week time period. And so this would change that provision.
So did that bill in 2007 expand it to 2 weeks from something else? I'm trying to remember back.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if you may, it went from zero to 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you.
And a lot of people got caught up in this, and I want to speak from not from the non-compete, but from the other side. A lot of small businesses have arbitration clauses in their employee handbooks. And, you know, a small business, even such as that I represent, over the years has could potentially have an arbitration clause for their employees, protect their employees as well as their business. And now you're going to force them to wait 2 weeks, and they used to just basically do it at the time of hire and the orientation.
Sure.
So,
got it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gilliam, did you want to speak to this bill?
Well, your vice chair needs to say who he is for the record.
Oh, well, forgive me.
Well, my good neighbor from next door upstairs is reminding me that this is Representative Kevin Cameron from South Salem, Almsville, Turner, House District 19. Thank you, Representative Gilliam, for running the committee.
What would we do without him?
I dream about it.
The Representative Bart Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple questions. I'd like to, I suppose, parse it down. First of all, I think the legal, our analysis as we approach this bill is very different between the arbitration clause and the non-compete clause. Legally speaking, there are very distinct issues with different consequences. And whereas I have little trouble with this bill with respect to the arbitration clause, indeed even moving it to zero, the non-compete gives me quite a bit more pause. And a few, first of all, it's not at all the fact that this bill, with respect to the non-compete, will create jobs is an assumption that does not necessarily follow. It's not obvious to me. Indeed, it could be argued, frankly, that with a significant pool, certainly specific industries, this will actually restrain people's ability to get jobs, depending on the industry. And also, I don't know that non-competes are only applied to, for example, the most significant positions. Senator, I gather that's how it operates in your company. But just based on my practice, I know it's very common practice for a broad range of employees and some of my clients, particularly those consulting firms, consultancies, things like that, in which it's very standard to have a non-compete. And the situation that concerns me here would be such where you have an existing employee, say low-level employee, who's about to be promoted to become sort of low-level manager. And as part of that promotion, they are offered A, the promotion, and that will have a non-compete. And it's imperative, I think, that the employee has significant time to confer with counsel, because that non-compete really has consequences. It has teeth, and it absolutely is going to change their career. And so they need to, A, I think, have an opportunity to check, talk to their lawyers, to understand what the non-compete means, and then think it through. And I think it's critical that they have that opportunity. How long that is that 72 hours enough? I'm a little nervous. Is 2 weeks too much? Probably. But I think that there's got to be some balance there between these interests. And not a question, I suppose, a statement. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I think, to your point, 72 hours obviously is the minimum. I mean, they have to wait 72 hours. But if you were an employer and you were negotiating with me for a potential non-compete, I could look at you and say, Representative Barton, I need another week to have my attorney, and we can obviously agree upon that. But if I was also fine with that, you had given it to me sooner, or for some reason I am an attorney and I can read that within 72 hours, we could, between the two of us, make a decision to go to work. As the statute says today, I can't go to work for 2 weeks, regardless of our negotiations. So I think there is some reasonable protections for me as an employee, as well as your opportunity to negotiate with me if you need me to start sooner and I'm comfortable with the agreement as you presented it. As I said before, I think for me, the arbitration clause in this bill is more important, but just to defend the non-compete agreement, I can see this as something that you and I can negotiate as an employer-employee relationship.
Senator, would you like to?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Barton. I may not be reading the bill correctly, but I believe that the existing language does anticipate the opportunity for advancement, and when that advancement occurs, that there is a non-competition agreement is entered into upon a subsequent bona fide advancement of the employee by the employer, and then the conditions that make it a perfectible instrument. So I think there is anticipation that you will have advancement, and that does occur, then there's conditions precedent to make it binding.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for bringing this forward. I think it's, you know, something we do need to talk about. I share some concerns about the non-compete agreement and the 72-hour time frame as well. And not so much, I think, that if an employee and employer decide that they don't want to wait 2 weeks, you know, that should be allowed, so they could go to work sooner. But on the flip side of that, I do share a little concern that somebody from across the country would, you know, make arrangements and come to some great expense to, you know, show up, you know, a week or 2 weeks ahead of time, and then only 72 hours ahead of time find out that there was a non-compete clause, which could be a major consideration for somebody's future. So I'm a little concerned about that aspect of it. I don't know if there's a way we could, you know, make it so it can happen, you know, 72 hours, but also, you know, make sure that people aren't, you know, making huge commitments and then finding out they're sort of, you know, at the last 72 hours that there's a non-compete clause, and they may be in an industry that goes, you know, gee, I just can't do that. I'm selling my future, you know, away. So I'm just a little worried about that piece of it.
And I express that myself. But once again, I mean, if I'm an employer and I'm highly skilled, in all likelihood, very well compensated employee, and they come from the East Coast to work for me, and I spring this on them, what kind of environment am I creating in my workplace? I tell you, and I'm not saying it can never happen. God knows there's enough idiots in this world that if you can think of it, it'll probably happen. But I just can't imagine why anyone would treat someone that way when they happy workers. I learned this on the yard from my concrete finisher foreman. Jerry Van Zant said, happy workers make happy products, when I was working for Morris Brothers. And it's true. And while I have to interject right there, I worked for Morris Brothers for a little under 3 years, and I learned a tremendous amount of knowledge. I can literally build and destroy any structure on the planet. And it helped me immensely in my own business, because there's nothing residential I can't build at all, ever. And I learned probably 85% of it while working for Senator Morris and his company. And they treated us very well, and I didn't take advantage of all the benefits I had, so I just wanted to point that out. But, yeah, I share that concern from a labor perspective. I hate non-competes. I don't even like them. I mean, if they tried to put one in a labor agreement, no way. But, I just feel that 2 weeks, in this day and age, I think you have some merit. Why should we deny someone the ability to go work for 2 weeks when that 1 week, a week and 2 days of paycheck can make a huge difference to a worker? But I do share your concern, Representative. Senator, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holby, the language of existing statute references a written employment offer. So if you have a written employment offer, you have to do it 72 hours before the person goes to work. If someone chooses to come and travel at their expense great distance without an employment offer, then that's the risk of the prospective employee. And maybe I'm not reading that language correctly, but I believe that it implies a written employment offer.
And Representative Holby, please.
Oh, thank you. I noticed that written employment offer too, but it still comes down to 72 hours before the first day of the employee's employment. So he could have the written employment offer, you know, ahead of being notified, the way I'm reading it, that there's a non-competition agreement. So, I mean, that's just my concern, that's all.
Let me share. Any further questions, these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure you know that the Senator and I will be rooting for the Beavers in the championship game tonight.
I wouldn't expect anything less, right?
The last Pac-10 school standing.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Beavers. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Let's see. Okay, we'll hear from somebody that has a different opinion. Roger Hannigan, please. Come on up, Roger. And then we'll follow up with Stephen Johnson and Jim Craven. And then if anybody else wants to testify, let me know. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Hennigan. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Lake Oswego. Not that it's relevant, but I'm also an elected legislator at the city level. And I'm the one who drafted what was HB 248 in the 2007 legislature and had it introduced by Representative McPherson. And there's been a couple of misconceptions about that, about the current status of the statute of the law already stated here this morning. it's important to remember one thing that's in the statute now that was not in it before 2007 is the fact that it only applies to employees who are going to be paid more than what is the medium wage for a family of four, which is in the range of $62,000 at the present time. Now, that was added in 2007. Previously, an employer could give an employee a written, they still can, a written employment, well, a written employment offer that would not mention a non-compete agreement, and then on the first day of employment, they could hand the employee a non-compete agreement in addition to any written offer without any prior notice. We negotiated back and forth. I would suggest that in this case of someone who is giving up another job somewhere else, agreeing to take a job and moving, or even giving up a job in the same vicinity and agreeing to transfer employment, it's only reasonable if you're in a job that pays a professional wage that you be given fair notice of the fact that the new employer is going to require a non-compete agreement. Now, I've drafted non-compete agreements for employers that I've represented, and I've represented employers in litigation trying to enforce non-compete agreements, and I've defended employees who were being sued by employers for allegedly violating non-compete agreements. There is nothing in the statute as it currently reads that would prohibit or preclude an employee from signing an employment agreement and a non-compete agreement and beginning employment immediately, so long as they were given the 2 weeks' notice that it would be required. Now, I have encountered situations where people gave up a prior job, made plans to move, and showed up and were required on the first day of employment to sign a non-compete agreement out of the blue. And I would suggest to you that there are employers. Now, I agree. I try to be a good employer. Mr. Chairman, you try to be a good employer and be fair to your employees.
Well, I've never employed anybody. It's all business, but I've never been an employer. Okay. Just keep the record straight here.
There are.
My wife's an employer, but I never have been.
There are employers who have sprung non-compete agreements on employees without any notice. And 2 years ago, we attempted to correct that situation with HB 248. It was enacted, and I would suggest to you that it's only reasonable to, if you're going to give an offer, a written offer, you would include notice of a non-compete, but there's nothing in the statute that would require you to do that. Vice Chair Barton, your situation is not covered by 653-295 the way it's currently written, because if you give an employee a bona fide advancement, you don't have to give them any prior notice the way the statute's written on a bona fide advancement. So I would ask you that 2903 be tabled. And I have been asked to inform you that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association also opposes 2903.
Let me ask a question, sir.
Sure.
Thank you for coming, too, by the way. And I agree you need a reasonable notice. Shouldn't be sprung on employees by a less than honest or decent employer, and I know they're out there, but the word reasonable has no quantification, no way of measuring it, no way of saying what is reasonable, black and white. I guess my question is, why is 2 weeks, other than it's a longer period of time, more reasonable than 72 hours? And I you know, you're going to say it is, someone else may say it isn't, and then we're sit here left to decide which is which. But I don't think there's any real explanation saying these are sophisticated people for the most part, by and large, we're talking about. And I work for Morse Brothers under a labor agreement, so I was protected, if you will. But I just don't see reasonable, in the end, it's like family values. Everybody has a different definition of it. So I just leave that hanging out there. If you want to respond to it, that's fine.
Well, there is, I mean, that's the reason we specifically said 2 weeks when we sat down in the work session 2 years ago. And before then, that didn't even say reasonable notice. It just said upon initial employment or upon a subsequent bona fide advancement. We talked about reasonable, but you know, if you end up in court, it's the judge or the jury who decides what reasonable is. We talked about what was reasonable and decided that 2 weeks was reasonable because almost anybody who's making more than $62,000 a year is going to give notice to their employer, their prior employer, more or at least 2 weeks in advance, if not a month in advance, and then learn 3 days before they start work that they're going to be required to sign a non-compete agreement after they've given notice and terminated their prior employment?
So it's a month, then 2 weeks out, they're in the same dilemma,
yeah, well,
whether it's 72 hours
I agree.
Not.
That's why I argued that a month was more reasonable.
Well, then 2 months. Either way. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed your testimony. I suppose, like mine, it was focused almost exclusively on non-competes. And, of course, legally speaking, the non-compete jurisprudence is very different than the arbitration clause. Does this bill, as applied to the arbitration clause, bother you in any way?
Not significantly. Not significantly. In the status of arbitration clauses as our arbitration requirements as they apply in the employment context has been in a real state of flux over the last 5 or 6 years. Federal courts have been dealing with it, state courts have been dealing with it, and we still don't know what the answer is. But as far as arbitration clauses, I don't have a significant problem with it.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hannigan, thank you for coming and testifying today. Did I just hear you say that you don't have a problem with reducing the time on the arbitration clauses of this bill? Is that what you said?
Not a substantial problem. I mean, if I'm representing an employee in a situation, it might cause me concern, but that's only because of my professional role. No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Vescovo, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, your scenario is one thing, but what about someone that's not working?
They can.
The other thing is, I want to get up, but I mean, there's two things to consider here. But the other thing is, what if we had something? What you're saying is a substantive contractual talk, where you have some contractual or employment talk. That's when that should be disclosed, no matter what. Bottom line, if I contacted you to come to work for me, whether it be on the phone, whether it be face-to-face or whatever, I should be telling you up front, and there should be some sort of ramifications and disciplinary actions, if I do not, that you have some damage. Because to me, first of all, I wouldn't come to work for you if you didn't tell me there was an agreement that I had to sign in the first place and you didn't disclose that. That tells me a lot about your firm. The second thing is there may be incurring damage to people. So why don't we word something to the point of where we start talking about what the offer will be that you have and must disclose up front, or there's a severe penalty? Well, why don't we structure it that way?
Well, it flies in the face of the common law that's been developed from the Industrial Revolution up to the current time in terms of the damage has always been
to the employee, to the employer when you go to work for the competitor, and it's the employer who's suing for damages. So I haven't ever contemplated, you know, revising the law in the way you suggest. That would be a revolutionary approach in and of itself.
Follow up.
And there's always next session. Representative Esquivel.
I'm sorry.
With regard to your first scenario, though, there's nothing that says that you can't sign it and go to work immediately. It's simply that the employer, if the employer has to give you no less than 2 weeks' notice of the intent to require it, but there's nothing that says the employee, you know, can't start work right away if they're told about it.
Yeah. Representative, do you need a follow up?
No, actually, I don't.
Okay, all right. Any further?
I don't want to muddy the water anymore than I have.
Yeah, I do want to follow up. How can the employee sign it and go to work if they haven't been given 2 weeks' notice?
Simply, the employer says, I have to give you 2 weeks' notice. Here's our non-compete agreement. We want you to sign it, and we want you to come to work for us 2 weeks from now. You can come to work earlier if you want.
That's not the way I read the statute, but well, anyways,
everything's open to interpretation.
I think you get it's something that it's a protection for the employee, and there's nothing that precludes the employee from waiving the 2 weeks if they're anxious to get to work.
Any further questions, Mr. Hannigan, today? Thank you, sir. I appreciate coming down.
Thank you.
I have Steve Johnson, Jim Craven, Alan Tressiter, please. And this is the last group I have, so if anyone else wants to testify when they're done, let me know. Whoever wants to go first, please.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm the president of a company by the name of Bibbs Industries, Inc., headquartered here in Salem. We're a hospitality company with interest in restaurants and hotels. We've been in business here since 1968. We're currently employing about 225 people here in the city of Salem. I'm here to speak specifically with respect to the arbitration provision of this bill, and I'd like to disassociate myself, my comments from any of the discussion about non-compete. I'd like to focus on the arbitration. I do think they're separate and distinct. What I wanted to do was provide an opportunity for you to see and appreciate the impact on employer and employee directly with respect to the two-week wait required by current law for the enforcement of an arbitration clause. I want to echo the comments that were made by Senator Morse with respect to the fact that there would be no springing of this issue upon the employee. Both with respect to the statute and also our actual practice. So as an illustration, I would share with the committee that which we do, and I think is required by the House bill here in front of us. We actually provide a written offer of employment to the employee after the interview process and the selection decision has been made that indicates very simply that we have elected to offer them employment with our firm, and we advise them specifically and exclusively to any other terms of the contract that there is a mandatory arbitration clause contained in our employee handbook. So this prospective employee receives this letter with that official notice in writing, and we then ask them to come back after the expiration of the applicable waiting period. Upon their return, the first thing we do is we undertake an orientation. They review in detail our employee handbook, which includes not only this provision regarding mandatory arbitration of any employment disputes that arise out of their employment, but all the other terms and policies, procedures, protocols that are applicable to their future employment with us. But the key is that with this illustration, you can see, as required by the statute, there's always an advance written notice of the fact that there is an arbitration clause required as a condition of their employment. Without providing that written offer previous to their actual appearance for work, that provision would be voidable and would not be enforceable. We've had in the last 2 years since the last session enacted this quite a number of people, obviously, that have been employed for whatever reason, whether it be a voluntary separation or an involuntary separation. We need to bring in new folks to our restaurants, to our hotels, and we've been required to wait 2 weeks before they're able to start work. I want to impress upon the committee, if I might, that from our actual experience, we can see that this is a significant burden on the employer. We don't have a situation typically, in fact, I can't think of any, where the prospective employee actually has another job and they're interviewing with us, they take their position, they can easily give notice to their current employer and then come to us without a lapse in work and pay. In point of fact, the situation is almost universally the reverse, which is we have a position that's available. We need, in order to continue to function and provide good service to our clients and customers, somebody in that position. And we find that person in quick and short order. We offer them the job. They've got to go sit for 2 weeks. So my point is that it's a significant burden upon us as an employer. It prevents us from efficiently operating our business, requiring us to operate short staff for a long period of time. And it also puts that employee typically without another job in place out of work for an additional 2 weeks. So in a very strict sense, this isn't stopping us from creating a job, but it is extending a period of unemployment, which is significant burden upon those folks working in our business. These are not these highly compensated people that have been the subject of discussion of the non-compete agreements. These are folks that need that money in order to pay their rent, in order to buy food for the family. So the arbitration clause is very significant. It's separate and distinct from the non-compete discussion that's been going on. And this 2 weeks is just incredibly burdensome upon both sides of that business, the employer and employee. We ask for some relief. The 72 hours seems appropriate, and we want to support that position.
Before we finish this pan out, I have to ask this question, because I always had two or three of those jobs all through college, except for when I worked full-time in a packing plant at night for 1 year. My question is, this two-week waiting period, is that, did you take that stand as your policy to hire from legal counsel, and was that counsel a result of their interpretation of what we passed 2 years ago?
Well, clearly the latter. We didn't. We had the same protocol preceding this, the passage of this bill 2 years ago, which was written discussion of the mandatory arbitration clause presented to the employee prior to the first day of work. But we didn't have a waiting period of any sort. With the passage of this law, we have had to change our protocol to provide that the employee may not appear for the first day of work until after 2 weeks have expired.
Thank you very much. Jim, then Alan, then we'll open it up for questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America. Tech America is the successor organization to what you've known as AEA over the last several years due to a merger with another large national group. I was an active participant in Senate Bill 248 last session, and maybe I can give just a real quick recap. It happened in the Judiciary Committee on the House side and Senate Business, so many of you were not in those rooms. And we did wrap it up somewhere in mid-June, so it was a lively conversation that lasted most of the session. Prior to Senate Bill 248 last session, as has been mentioned before, the only limits on non-competes were prior to the first day of work, fairly vague standard, and upon significant bona fide advancement. That was it. And I'm speaking to the non-compete part of this debate. Due to some perceived abuses, and I say perceived because some of the stories maybe were not as specific and to the point as would have been probably wished, this legislature made a wholesale rewrite of the non-compete part of the statute. You know, this bill only focuses on the hours part, but you as a body did a lot of things. You said you have to be an exempt employee as defined in statute. So you couldn't, there was a perception that non-competes were being slapped on hourly wage workers. So you said, A, you have to be exempt under the existing ORS statute. Two, as has been pointed out, you had to have a fairly high wage threshold linked to a Census Bureau hard number. And right now it's $62,000, $63,000 a year. The company had to have a protectable interest. You couldn't do this arbitrarily. You had to say that there was an interest, trade secrets, competition, whatever. You could only do them for 2 years. That had kind of been the trial law standard, but it had not been codified, so 2 year limit. And we did some really complicated stuff for on-air radio, television, broadcast talent that I never did understand at the time, and probably still don't. So
I think I would be the result of being chair of the business committee on the other side of the building.
I could have had to do with dismissals of famous on-air talent and the fact that they had non-competes. But anyway, so you did all these things to really narrow down the ability of employers to use these. And I think probably appropriately, a lot of things. Higher level people, protectable interests, etc. The one thing that the bill did that I have heard feedback from my members, by and large in the technology industry, these are used at very high level people. They're not used at factory floor positions, whatever. So the wage limit, the 2 year, all seem fairly reasonable in our negotiations. The one thing I have heard subsequently to the session is the two-week limit. And I've heard it exactly in the context of, I've got work to do. This person's standing on my doorstep, ready to go to work. I say, when can you start? He says, what time is it? And we say, come back in 2 weeks if I want to be able to enforce a non-compete agreement. So I think 2 years ago, we were sort of in a labor shortage economy. Right now, we are in a lots of willing worker economy. And for those employers who actually are hiring, and there still are some, it has been perceived as an impediment. Now, again, a couple other points. It is at least 72 hours. It's not, you can't show anybody till 3 days before they start working. Most reasonable employers, you know, do a better job than that. I think the one point in Roger Hannigan's testimony, I don't see in the statute the waivability. And maybe that's a way to get to yes on this issue. In the floor debate in the House, a few people who supported the bill said, well, you can bring them on, sign the agreement, and you can bring them on like as an independent contractor or something for a couple weeks until they're... But that is fraught with enormous dangers to employers to try to bring someone as a contingent employee when they're really an employee. The independent contractor law does not allow that in Oregon.
We're going to talk about that at length here.
Yeah. Another fun bill. So anyway, that's just, I wanted to give you a little history of the discussions. And the one residual issue from other people had different points of view, but from our point of view in the technology industry, the 2 weeks is the one piece I've heard from employers saying, why on earth did they do that? So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Alan Trussiter. I'm here today representing Nike. I just want to touch a little bit on what Mr. Craven just said, because I don't believe he gave you the flavor of the debate last session. I mean, if I had to pick three bills that I spent more time than any other on of the hundreds of bills I deal with, Senate Bill 248 is right near the top of the list. I feel like I'm tiptoeing through the landmines in Southeast Asia again, waiting for one to blow me up. There were dozens of different interest groups involved in the crafting of this bill. I think in the end, as we frequently do around this building, we solved a very thorny problem in a very creative way, and it involved lots and lots of people, and which is the hallmark of this legislature, is the ability to do that. My only word to you today is I have only a little bit of heartburn about opening up the statute and changing it. I don't think changing the 2 weeks violates the intent of this law. There are a number of colleagues who are not here today that I think you may want to reach out to, or it may be, yeah, you weren't here too bad you missed it. We're moving on. I certainly don't want to be debating this issue in late June like we were last session again, because it was late June. And you know that a bill that has Senate Bill number 248 on it, if we were still debating in June, had some controversy wrapped around it. I agree with my colleague, Mr. Craven. I don't see the waivability in here. I think you have to give somebody 2 week notice and wait 2 weeks before they go to work. If there is such a waivability, I think that may solve most of your problem. But like I say, that's unclear to me that it is here. Prior to last session, you said that these were highly compensated. They are reasonably compensated individuals today, but we had testimony last session, you know, that SmartPark employees had to sign non-competes, that people that worked at quick copy stores had to sign non-competes. Now, whether that was factual or not, I'm unclear, but I just know that the committee made some decisions to establish an income threshold, which makes a great deal of sense to me. So they are reasonably well compensated employees now. Trade secrets, which is my client's concern. I mean, we're designing shoes that were made of materials that haven't been designed yet. But we know that when the shoe is out there in 10 years, those materials that weigh virtually nothing will have been designed. I mean, we protect those interests. But there are a lot of ways to protect trade secrets other than with non-competes. We do use them for our highly compensated engineers who are working with very sensitive materials. Beyond that, we do not. But I think my only word of caution is tread lightly here. This was a very well-crafted, finely-tuned piece of legislation. No doubt there were some things we could have done better if we hadn't been dealing with this on, like, the 20th of June. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it's those SmartPark or whomever non-competes that just drive me to distraction.
Right. You did get rid of that.
Pardon me?
You did get rid of that.
Yeah.
And SmartPark employees are getting a lot more money than I think they are.
Well, I was actually an attendant at one of those parking garages when I first started my own small business. At night, I worked there 8 hours at night, and then I went and worked all day the next day, and just to make sure I had a guaranteed source of income, and it was not very much. Okay. But I would like to also take this opportunity, Mr. Tressider, to thank you for your service to this nation. I worked with you for 6 years before I was even aware of your experience overseas, and I just wanted to publicly thank you for it.
Thanks,
so, Mr. Chair. My pleasure. Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Cameron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tressider, you said we got rid of the SmartPark people. Wouldn't that be based strictly on the income?
Yes. Okay. If there were a SmartPark employee that was making $100,000 a year,
okay,
then this bill would apply.
Okay. And we've heard testimony today about separate issues, arbitration versus non-compete.
Yes. The arbitration change doesn't give me any heartburn at all.
Okay. If it went to zero, does it give you any heartburn? Because that's what the statute was before last session.
I'd want to check and get back to you.
But 72 hours doesn't give you any heartburn.
No.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, if it is the pleasure of the chair and the committee, we could go out in a fairly rapid time and explore the issue of waivability, if that's a niche of a solution that makes sense, or support the 72
hours. On that right there, I think we put a time period in there to protect workers. You put the ability to waive it. Okay, now I'm a less than scrupulous employer, and I say, sign this right now. Waive your rights now, or you don't get the job.
I understand.
And I'm not really interested in going down that road. I don't know, maybe the chair.
Mr. Chair, it's a question. I have no idea if the courts have resolved this issue whatsoever. We're hearing conflicting testimony, which tells me it's probably ambiguous. And I don't know if there are any pending litigation whatsoever, but I suspect some. It's a question of fact. The courts might have already even applied it, whether we like it or not. I simply don't know.
All I know is I don't want to have an employee stuck in a situation where they feel they have to waive their rights. I don't even like that idea.
Yeah. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Gilliam sitting here listening to this testimony, he and I were the sponsors of this bill, and what we were trying to do was help
small employers with arbitration clause, and I think that's what we really would like to focus on. So I'd like to bring forth some amendments that would specifically do that. We've heard testimony that there's no heartache over what this does, and so I'd like to, when we get to a work session on this bill, bring forth amendments that would focus on that.
Well, Representative, we're going to have a full public hearing on any amendments.
Right.
Because we're talking about this language, and I have no idea what you're talking about. So that remains to be seen, but I appreciate that. Any further questions? Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And we don't have the paperwork to work this bill today, so we'll look forward to any language that's brought forth regarding this issue. But I want to just repeat what Mr. Tressiter said. I think we should tread very lightly in this area, because I have some very core values that I hold and dear to me when it comes to people being hired and any agreement they sign regarding non-compete or arbitration. So there you go. All righty then. I'm going to close public hearing, House Bill 2903. Where are we now? I open a public hearing on House Bill 2957.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2957 directs the Public Employees Benefit Board, otherwise known as PEB, to make one or more supplemental employee-paid insurance plans available to eligible employees, retired employees, and family members.
Okay. Representative Thatcher, would you like to come and shed some light on this issue for us, please?
If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring up my assistant Paul and
come right on up, folks.
Robin.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Come right on up. Is that for these folks?
And I will go first. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from Newburgh, Kaiser, and St. Paul. And I bring you this bill just to provide access to group rate supplemental health insurance for supplemental insurance, not just health insurance, for state workers. And actually, this came from my constituent, Paul Finster, and he is a local insurance agent. Just the only thing I'm going to say is that over the past 5 years, there have been attempts to get this benefit added to the Public Employee Benefit Board, but to date they have been unsuccessful, so we're trying to go through the legislature since they don't seem to want to do that. So I'm going to have Paul give you some of the details on this very simple bill, and by the way, it will cost the state zero money. And it will go a long ways towards providing a good benefit to our state workers. So, yeah, with that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, thank you so much for this opportunity this morning. As Representative Thatcher indicated, this bill is a very simple one-page document.
Oh, sir, you have to identify yourself for the record, please.
Is that a little better this morning?
You have to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Paul Finister. I am a licensed independent insurance agent here in the state of Oregon. And as Representative Thatcher indicated, this is a very simple one-page bill. And all it does is allow the opportunity for the people who help keep this state operational and functional to have access to supplemental insurance benefits at a payroll rate. And it also gives opportunity for the people of the state to have, especially, and I don't have to remind any of us of the economic climate we're in right now, but it just gives them options, it gives them choices on different ways that they can help to protect themselves and their families. We're not making this a complicated bill by any means. We just want to have it to where it can be used as a tool to help give that additional coverage to these people. One of the things that I would like to throw into this is the, and I think all of you should have a copy of the highlight sheet here, is that HB 2957 allows state employees to purchase this insurance at an affordable payroll rate, but also it gives, again, that much needed additional financial protection to their families. We have sat many times and watched and spoken with different people who work for this great state, sit there and discuss the fact of how their savings have been just simply dwindled away, how they've been hit with unexpected medical issues that have caused tremendous hardship on them, and this is that opportunity to help protect them against that. Now, what some of this basically stemmed from is in the latter part of 07, I started a survey to really see what the interest level would be. We conducted this survey for about a year. We ended it in November of 08, and then we compiled the results from that, and I brought with me, and I would like, if I may use this as just a visual, to show you a bit of what we did on this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right here is a sampling of the survey sheets that we got back from across the state. These came from departments ranging everything from forestry to DHS. And in so doing, it gave us an opportunity to really see what the interest level would be out there. And what I would like to do, if I may, is just read to you some of the comments that we got back as we did this survey. And some of the comments these people gave us. I used to have supplemental. I would like to have it again. I think more people would be interested if they heard about these programs and their availability. I have one policy and would be interested in other policies. And it goes on. I have about 8 or 9 pages here of comments that have come in that we gleaned from this, from these survey sheets here.
You don't need to read those.
So
we believe you.
Thank you, sir.
I would like you to share a copy of your survey with us, though.
We'd be happy to.
The questions on it and the results, if you have that data.
I do have that, if you'd like.
Whenever you get around to it, just share it with the committee administrator, and she'll get the rest. She'll get the information to the one.
Very good. Be happy to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Robin Webb, and I have been a state employee for approximately 11 years. I currently have 3 supplemental insurance policies, which I pay the higher rate for. I would encourage you guys to look at this bill and vote in favor of allowing state employees such as myself to have a discounted payroll rate, especially in light of furlough days that we're going to be looking at taking, and then for this next biennium, it would be very beneficial to have that discounted rate because we really need the supplemental insurance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are you finished? Excuse me.
Yes.
Okay. And thanks for bringing this, Representative. On when you provide us with the questions and the results, the data, if you would then want to share with us examples of the comments inside that little packet, I'd appreciate that too. It isn't that I'm not interested in the 8 or 9 pages. I just don't want to spend time listening to 8 or 9 pages of testimony because we're always in a hurry around here. Do you have any idea, Ms. Webb, how much you would have saved on those 3, and this may be a question for you, sir, those policies, had you been allowed to buy it through a group rate?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is on one of my policies, it would be about a $20 a month discount, and I have 3 separate policies.
Right, so it adds up. And then, can anybody explain to me exactly why? What's the justification of the board saying, no, we don't want to allow this group to go out and purchase? Is there somebody? Okay, we're going to have somebody come up in a minute and explain that to us. So, Representative Cameron, any questions?
And then thank you, Mr. Chair. In your handout sheet, it says no cost to state budget, administrative costs built into the program. Can you describe for me how the state is compensated for their administrative costs to send the checks and do all that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, that's a great question. I would like to address that simply by saying what we are doing is in the body of the bill itself. We have language in there that would allow the Public Employees Benefit Board to charge a small fee. It could be just an example, maybe $1 per policy to help cover the cost of someone sitting there doing the data entry and overseeing the program from their site as well. So we want to make sure that, and I believe, and I stand corrected, my colleague from PEB may shed more light on this, but I believe one of the issues that was raised was the cost of administration. And again, I don't have to remind everyone where we are in the economy right now. We understand that as a valid concern. And so in so structuring the bill, we did it in such a manner that that would that issue would be addressed by allowing a small fee to be assessed to help cover that administrative cost.
Well, we're going to let them speak for themselves here in a minute, but I have a feeling a dollar per policy ain't going to be enough. Representative Kenneth, are you finished, Representative?
Well, I just wanted to, the fee charged to who? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My pleasure.
Who pays the fee?
That would be assessed to the policy owner, the person who purchases the policy. There would be right on there a fee that would help to cover that administrative cost.
Thank you. Representative Kenneth.
Just kind of a general question. What kinds of policies are likely to be supplemental policies? What do they cover?
Chair Schaffler, Representative, I think the way I can best answer that question for you would be a variety depending upon the need of the individual. Some people who have a large family obviously find themselves in a situation where an accident policy would be the best. If you have someone who has, for example, a history of cancer in their family, obviously at that point the cancer plan would be most appropriate. And I believe at that time, as each person's need is individually addressed, that policy could be brought into effect that would best address that need.
Follow up,
please.
Just in generalities, what kind of numbers are how many different kinds of supplemental policies are in the marketplace? I'm just really not familiar with the market on this.
You know, and I have found that, again, Representative, to be a very common thing, and the more that people are educated, the more they realize how much value something like this can bring. Mm-hmm. Now, if I might, may digress for just a moment. I personally have had a situation in my own family where this has happened. Finding out later that we could have purchased a policy that could have covered the majority of those costs would have saved our family thousands of dollars. And so does that somewhat answer your question? Do you want me to go a little further, sir?
Well, I suspect I'll learn later, but I'm just trying to understand what the menu is that one can choose from.
Well, the menu itself, in essence, can be drawn from about five to six good policies, and there are various companies that offer policies that would cover those fields. You have cancer, obviously, is a huge issue. You have heart issues. That is a big issue right now, especially with people in the baby boomer generation, all those cholesterol people who ate too many Big Macs 20 years ago. So there is a variety there. There can be a supplemental to a vision. There can be a supplemental to a dental. There can be supplemental to a disability. There can be supplemental to accident. You know, there's a number that
like nursing facilities and that kind of thing.
There's quite a is a wide variety that can meet the needs of the people.
Thank you.
You know, and if you're paying $20 a month, there's probably a sweet spot in there where you could find administrative costs you'd find acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confident it'd be more than a dollar a policy.
I would.
We're going to find out about that right now.
And I would use that, Mr. Chair, I would use that just as an example.
Yeah.
Conversation.
I understand. Any further questions, these good people? All right. Thank you, Representative Prince. I'd like to call Bobby Barnett with the Public Employee Benefits Board. Come on up here. Share her wisdom with us. And you've heard a lot of the questions. If you want to just answer them or speak to them, please. And thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bobby Barrett.
Oh, forgive
me. Excuse
me.
It's okay.
Barrett, not Barnett.
And I'm the PEB Plan Design Manager. I was asked to come today in case you had questions regarding this bill and what the board has done in the past regarding supplemental insurances. There are currently two statutes that allow the board to take supplemental insurances for state employees, and the board does look at supplemental insurances on an annual basis. We have vendors that come forward to us each year, and they are presented to the board, and the board can make a selection at that time if they'd like to add anything. Currently, on our supplemental insurances, which employees pay for out of their own pocket, we have short-term and long-term disability, we have long-term care, we have accidental death and dismemberment, And we have some optional life insurances as well, both for dependents and spouses and domestic partners. So we do offer that at this time. Recently, we did present to the board approximately 8 companies that had come forward to the board, and the board at this time chose to decline adding supplemental insurances. There is an administrative cost. We have an electronic enrollment system, which, as you can imagine, has to coordinate both with the vendor that we have as well as the payrolls. And there is a lot of cost to working those software applications. One item that hasn't been discussed in this bill is the inclusion of local government. Currently, PEB does not service local government or semi-local or political subdivisions such as Metro. We would have to build that into our administrative costs to be able to do that. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about this bill.
Several, if not all of those that you just rattled off, I take advantage of myself. Is it possible for you to look at my pay stub and tell me how much administrative costs each one of those supplemental insurance policies cost the board and give me that information?
We could probably analyze that and come back to you with that, Chair.
Maybe I'm not an average. Maybe I'm not an average worker, but at least I can't imagine my supplemental policy administrative costs would be any, if it's the same policy, would be any different from a correction worker or a DHS worker. It'd probably be the same administrative cost.
Yes,
so
it would be.
I would like that just for my own, and I'll share it with my colleagues here so we have an idea on what I'm talking about. Can you tell me, though, on the 8 vendors that came forward, and I don't need to know who they are, what was the reasoning behind denying them access to this pool of workers for these group rates? What happened there, Dean?
Well, I can't really speak for the board, but a lot of it has to do with the administrative costs and bringing it forward. The payroll system that we go through currently is takes a lot of programming, and most of the vendors would like to have those premiums adjusted out of the payroll check rather than as an electronic reversal out of your checking account or your savings account. So there does come into some programming issues for not just for PEB, but for other agencies, both the university system as well as the state payroll system.
I currently pay my premium right out of my check.
Correct.
Automatically on my stub.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't itemize what the administrative cost is.
No.
Yeah, okay. Representative Kennedy, please.
What happens when an employee has one of these supplemental programs and they retire?
On the short-term and long-term disability, that's discontinued. On the optional life insurances that can be ported or converted into whole life. Long-term care continues on. So accidental death and dismemberment discontinues as well.
As long as you're willing to pay the premium.
As long as you're willing to pay the premium, yes, sir.
Okay. Representative, please.
And why some are carried on and some are not?
Well, they're not actually carried on through
or
PEB.
Allowed on, I'm
right.
Sorry.
They're not carried on through PEB at that point. At that point, the insurer steps in and works directly with that individual. So they are not administered through PEB or through PERS. We have no connection between PEB and PERS.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, another
go ahead.
Follow-up. And what's PEB's view about this bill?
Well, supplemental insurance is a good thing. However, at this time, administratively, I would have to say for the board that they would be looking at extensive costs.
I guess my question then is what's the benefit of the state to just leaving it totally to the board having control over this or us taking some proactive stand like this bill? Is it strictly because of cost or is it because we believe the board is more qualified to do that than we are, which may well be true? In fact, I would probably say they are. But is it strictly administrative cost today that you're representing the board saying you're concerned about?
I believe I am.
Yeah, great. Thank you very
Mr.
much.
Chair.
Representative Cameron. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of brings up something that I've thought about in the past and been brought to my attention by some of my constituents. and that is, I guess when you retire in the state of Oregon, you go out of the main pool and you go into a retirement pool, which in turn jumps your cost $300 to $400 a month. Is that correct?
Not on the PEB plan for retirees. Excuse me. You can take the PEB health care plans up until your Medicare age. Usually that's age 65. And the premium is the same except for a small administrative cost. So we're looking at about 102%, the same amount. The plans are different under PERS.
And it must be PERS. In fact, it would have been PERS. Because I understand that we moved those people within the last few years out of PERS and actually cost our retired employees about $300 to $400 a month by moving them from one group to another, which I thought was pretty shoddy on the part of the state of Oregon.
Yeah. Would the initial cost come out of the fund? And is it the initial cost to get it all going you're concerned about? Because clearly the maintenance of the policy is paid by the policy holder. It's that initial startup. Do you have anything on the top of your head? Because we have to go to a work session to get a measure summary. Do you have any idea what the startup would be for this bill?
Mr. Chair, I don't, but I'd be happy to get that for you.
I would really appreciate that, because I'm sympathetic to this. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I am sympathetic, too, to the fact that the board doesn't want to spend a bunch of money, especially in light of the article that was in the paper yesterday. So I'm sympathetic to that, too. But I would be interested to see what it would cost to get this going. Okay. But then after that, it's maintained by the policyholder, so unless I'm missing something. Any further questions of Ms. Barrett? And forgive me, I thought I read it. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. And look, and get all that information to the administrator, please, and she'll share it with all of us. I'm going to call Brian DeLashmit, Mary Botkin, and our good friend Ted Hughes. Come on up. Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association today, actually setting in just to learn a little bit more about this bill and what it actually did, and decided that I would engage, as I do occasionally. The issue that Senator or Representative almost elevated to there, Senator Escobar.
I don't know. I've been there. So.
Yeah, you've been there. Yeah.
I don't think it's...
It is an issue that's been brought to my attention, too, and I think one of the constituents that he's talking about is a retired state trooper who found that when he went to get insurance through, and I believe it was PEB, but now there seems to be confusion whether it's PEB or PERS, that post-retirement that his insurance rates went up between $300 and $400. So obviously we need to evaluate that and find out which one of the two plans. I'm a little surprised to hear that in PEB a retired state employee can continue their insurance and it's only 102% of what the rate would be for a currently employed person. But we do have an interest in this particular issue. Let me give you also one little glimpse of something that I'm working on along with Representative Cameron and a number of others. In fact, Mr. Chair, I think you signed on to the bill too. Senate Bill 821 that deals with retirees' health insurance as well. What it does is it establishes within the state the ability to have a retirement medical trust. So as you're an employee, as you're working your life as a current employee, you'll be putting money in a trust that you can then purchase health care when you're retired, which would vastly help in a lot of cases as well. And that's what I wanted to add to the equation. But I think there's a little confusion as to whether or not we're talking PEB or we're talking PERS, and I was under the impression we really were talking PEB, and I'm still not convinced that we're not talking PEB with the retired employee that that Representative Escobar is talking about. Thank you.
And before we go to Mary, House Bill 2405 will be carried over to Wednesday in case anybody's waiting around or listening to that. Mary, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I want to echo what Brian said. I think there's some confusion here. I know that at one point under PEB, they moved retirees out of the group health care, and retirees were faced with significant increases in their monthly costs as a result of that. When we moved them back in, I believe their cost decreased, but the overall cost their cost decreased, but the overall cost of the system increased. And I'm with Brian at this point. What I'd like to do is get some clarification. Diane Lovell is one of my colleagues over at AFSCME, and she has been on PEB and was chair of the PEB board for many years. And I'd like to check with her and find out exactly what's the problem here and what kind of supplemental insurances do we offer, and if we're offering supplemental insurances through PEB, then is this really a bill about an insurance company that was not selected? And if they were not selected, or if there were a group of insurance companies that were not selected, was there a reason they weren't selected? And, you know, what's the process? And I really don't know the intricacies of the process that PEB uses. I have absolute confidence in that board and their ability and their selection of insurance companies. I don't know what they use, and I don't want to.
Well, Mary, we're going to find out. I asked Ms. Barrett to get that information, and any information you find, share with Teresa.
I will share with the rest of us.
So, anything else?
Generally, we like supplemental insurance.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea, and I think people should have it available to them. And if it's not being made available, then let's figure out why, mm-hmm. and see if we can fix it.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Thank you. I'm going to go to Ted Hughes, and then we'll open it up to questions. Mr. Hughes. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes representing
Aflac.
One of the carriers whose existence is because of supplemental insurance. That's all we do. We have some 8 different kinds of supplemental insurance. An example of how supplemental insurance works: it's purchased by the individual, not by the establishment. They make the decision. If they were to get cancer or whatever, if they had a cancer policy, the check is made to the individual, not to the hospital, not to the doctor, for incidental expenses. And they are, in the case of cancer, the example I'm using are very, very severe, the incidental expenses. So I thought I'd come up and talk a little bit about supplemental and how it works. It's strictly voluntary, and you can choose from an array, and it's individual-based. It's not group policies. And when you retire, you're already accustomed to paying the minimal reduced amount. You can take it with you. It's portable. And so that's about all I wanted to say about Aflac, but I hope it helps your discussion.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you said you can take the Aflac insurance with you. Can I sign up for Aflac insurance today and have it deducted out of my checking account?
Mr. Chairman, you can arrange with your employer to have it deducted. Yes, you can.
Let me go back and ask the question again. Can I, as an individual, sign up for Aflac insurance and have it deducted directly out of my own personal checking account? It has nothing to do with my employer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, you can.
This one he didn't. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions of these good people? Representative Kent.
Thatcher, please.
Thatcher works. I'll answer that.
I want to call everybody Cameron today.
Well, I just want to make it clear that a lot of the state employees do have this, and they do have gone out on their own to get supplemental insurance from various companies, and all this is just allowing them to get a group rate. It would discount. It would allow them to purchase it at a lower cost. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing the information from the board. I'm struggling as to why we don't do this.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative Thatcher hit on an important thing. The only reason to involve an organization rather than an individual is that you can give that individual, when they purchases the policy, strictly voluntarily, a reduced rate if you're endorsed by organizations such as PEP. You get a reduced rate rather than buying it off the street.
Well,
Now, the initial startup costs, I understand, it's going to cost some money. I understand that. But I don't understand why we would deny people the ability to get into this after that initial cost. And you could even work something in to repay that initial cost. And when it's done, the fee could be reduced slightly or just left the same. Nothing goes down anymore. But, okay, Mary, one more comment.
I was just going to say, I think that under group insurance, they would not have the ability to decline coverage to any individual in that group either. And so, you know, you need to be very clear that when you go to a group policy, there's no adverse selection, if you will.
It's even better for the worker.
It's better for the worker, providing that that is indeed what we're doing.
Yeah, which I don't know.
I don't
okay.
either.
Okay, all right. Representative Matthews, one more, and then we're moving on.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just a quick comment, by the way, and I'm a fan. I'm probably 22-year contributor to Aflac and three different plans and policies, and I have to say I've yet to benefit from them, even though I've had some serious injuries along the way, and it's
free
just
to
my
God
fault.
You never do, Representative.
The bottom line is, exactly, I think, you know, when we hear in this building of the death of 1,000 cuts, I sympathize with a lot of the agencies out there, because really, we think about the initial cost, but it is work, it is resource, it is the availability of people. Even though you have outside agents contracting, you still have internal people that are having to coordinate these activities, having to get people together, having to work it through payroll and do finance. So I can speak on behalf of the City of Gresham with the human resources diminishing their resources. One more thing to them probably doesn't go really well, but they've been offering these. But I just want to say on behalf, I mean, I'm looking forward to getting the numbers, and I appreciate you being here. But this is one of those things where it's just kind of piling on work that's going away. And it doesn't seem like a lot, but in its totality, it becomes quite a bit.
And I thought I made it clear earlier. We have to pay for the administrative cost of this. They're not just stick this burden on some nebulous agency out there. We have to come up with the money before we can do it. Otherwise, we can't do it. And the amount that was thrown out earlier was just for the sake of conversation, and that's all it is, because I'm sure it's more than that, and we need to find out how much it is before, and I'm talking to the department now, and I definitely agree with Representative Matthews. We just can't set this up and say, okay, now go do it. We have to have the money to do it, or we can't do it. All right, with that, I appreciate everybody coming down.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Just a quick comment. Those costs, this bill will allow those costs to be built in.
Yes, absolutely.
So it should be cost neutral to the agency.
I think you're exactly right, Representative. I couldn't agree more. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew we were all on the same page. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2957 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2739.
Mr. Chair, Committee members, House Bill 2739 modifies the motor vehicle inventory for which a auto dealer may be allowed fair and reasonable compensation upon the termination, cancellation, non-renewal, or discontinuance of the franchise. The measure also increases the amount of damage to a new motor vehicle requiring disclosure to the prospective purchaser. You have in front of you a -2 amendment which to make some clerical changes to the bill that keeps the intent the same.
And Representative Escovel and Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Campbell, would you like to approach too? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6. You have in front of you House Bill 2739, which basically, in this type of an economy we have today, it protects our car dealers, because what is happening in the new car industry and what we're concerned with is when these car dealerships go out of business for one reason or another, that the manufacturer themselves are undercutting the inventory prices, which hurts them even more. Example, let's say you, for every dollar, maybe you're only getting 70 cents on the dollar for restocking. So they're charging you basically a restocking fee, and that's something that we'd like to prevent to protect our businesses here in the state of Oregon. You see several, it's a pretty basic type of a bill here, and we've all read this bill. We know that there's some ramifications here on size and weight, mileage, the whole thing on this. The I really don't have much to say about it, except that we're trying to protect some of our people that may have some problems here in the future, and that's exactly what we want to do, and or we're trying to return inventory that maybe they're overstocked. So without further ado, I'll turn this over to Mr. Gallagher here and let him proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Auto Dealers. Unfortunately, in the last downturn economy, over 19 Oregon dealerships closed in 2008. The economic impact of an auto dealership in Oregon is fairly large. There are about 269 dealerships in Oregon. The average number of employees is about 61 employees, and they do multiple millions of dollars worth of business in every local community in terms of payroll, charitable activities, and so forth. I'm glad to be here with the representatives of the automobile manufacturers, and there's no opposition to this bill. It's fairly simple. What we want to do is we want to fix about four things in the bill that have been issues over the last few years because of lack of clarity. We fully expect that more dealerships will close, that the pressures on the national manufacturers and the push to cut costs is going to have a ripple-down effect in Oregon. So taking care of some of these outstanding problems will be fairly helpful for us. If I would, Mr. Chair, I'd just walk quickly through the four pieces of the bill. I would like to also take you through the Dash 2 amendments at the same time, because otherwise what I'm going to talk about won't make a lot of sense.
Can you do it in like 5 minutes, Tom?
I was going to give you three.
You're fine, America.
All right. If you look on page 1, line 12, you'll see that the current language says all new current model year. The issue here is a dealership a couple years ago in Bend that got closed and the manufacturer had skipped a year. So instead of having a 2009 and a 2010, they had a 2009-2011. That left a controversy over whether the 2009s were actually covered because they weren't in the current model year. What we've done in the amendment is change the language model year to calendar year. So a 2009 model may come out and will come out in 2008. What we're saying is the model of the current year and the subsequent year are the models that are covered that the manufacturer will take back. The next one is also on line 12, which is a gross weight of 8,500 pounds. That exempts trucks. There are a number of truck franchises that are also having trouble, so we're going to put the trucks back in the bill. You'll see some language later on in the amendment that talks about the weight of trucks and the number of miles a truck can travel. An automobile is usually delivered on a trailer transport. A truck you have to drive. So the miles that keep a car from being a used car are in the 300s, but a truck, they're in the thousands. So that's another issue. On the next page, on line 41 at the bottom of page 2, you'll see we're changing that the damage of a vehicle in transit goes from $500 to $1,000. And in Section 6, it talks about we have to notify the customer if they have a car that had now $1,000 worth of damage on it. If you go back up to Section 5, you'll see that when the total value of the repairs by the manufacturer that have to be reported, that number also triggers when the manufacturer will take the car back. So if you lose a taillight and your car gets scratched up in transit, in this case, because you'd have to tell the buyer about that and it would lower the value of the car, the manufacturer would take it back. So those are basically the changes in the bill. I'll stop.
All right, Greg.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here representing General Motors in support of the bill and in support of the amendments that are being offered by the Automobile Dealers Association. Very briefly, the change to the calendar year, it just clarifies things because different manufacturers identify their model years differently, and this makes it very clear because it's based upon when the product was actually produced. A model year can extend really over three calendar years, and so this clarifies in very specific terms what we're talking about, what the dealer can expect under the bill. So very briefly, we're supportive of the amendments, and as you may guess, the the organization that I represent is feeling the bite as well. So this is something that the automotive dealers and manufacturers are kind of in together. So thank you.
And just so I get this down, I have Mr. Cosgrove, who represents the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers. Do you want to speak to that for me, one of you guys?
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Craig Campbell. Yes, on behalf of Mr. Cosgrove and the Alliance, they are also supportive of the amendments.
All right, thank you very much. Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, my question, and either one of the panel, has to do more. I like the bill. I don't have a problem. I'm going to call a couple dealerships. But the damage amount from $500 to $1,000, in the interest of customer protection, I would think, or consumer protection, I would think that people would want to know. You know, now in a taillight, I get that. If a taillight's broken, big deal, you replace it, and that's okay. But if you get a substantial door ding, fenders fogged in, that can be relatively easy to repair for the lot. But that's going to really upset somebody with a brand new car that all of a sudden, a year and a half later, they see this you know, pattern on their car. I'm just kind of curious why we want to double that now from five to 1,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, it has to do with the way the particular statute is constructed. It would make a whole lot more sense if that section wasn't Section 5, but Legislative Council does not often take my advice as to how things are done. So the way this works is that we will notify the person. And $500 worth of damage or $1,000 worth of damage is truly cosmetic right now, because all these are module parts being replaced. So you crash out a tail light, you know, as it slides around. You put the whole thing back in. There's no real damage to the car. In this case, though, from the dealer's point of view, under Section 5, we'd want to return that car to the manufacturer. So that's why the number goes up.
I see. Thank you.
If you come back a year and a half with a dent in your car, I doubt you're going to get much sympathy. But I do share his concern, you know. We don't want to let people off. We bought a van once, and I walked around it and found all these scratches that somebody put on while sitting in the lot. And we would have driven right off that lot if I hadn't said, hey, I want that buffed out of there. And they did, of course, but it would have cost me some money. Any further questions, these fine Americans? Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, also remember that these manufacturers do have some substantially fairly decent, in my opinion, and are becoming more decent warranties, because that's what they have to sell. They have to sell warranties, you know, and you can get warranties for those, but for the first year to 3 years, they're pretty well covered.
I think there's some satellite out there that has chips and all these cars, and the minute my warranty gets up, everything starts going to hell. They send a signal down and it starts going chunk chunk chunk. That's what I think, but
Mr.
I have
Chair,
no evidence to prove that.
That's actually been proven with golf clubs.
All right, thank you very much, guys, for coming down. Anyone else want to testify to House Bill 2739? And when we get the fiscal and the revenue, we'll be back to this. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2739. And members, just for future reference, we're waiting for a lot of fiscal and revenue summaries. And when they get here, we're working these bills out. So come to vote. Be prepared to vote. We're not going to spend a lot of time on some of them. Matter of fact, most of them, like this is a perfect example, we're going to move them out, and it's going to go really fast. So know what we're voting on. Know what you're voting on when you come here, because we're going to we may all push up into a day in April where we have to just move them out. So with that, open a House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 2953.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2953 provides that a contracting agency may reject a bid for a public improvement contract if the bidder does not demonstrate that they are responsible. The measure outlines that the bidder must demonstrate responsibility by showing that they have licenses and that service, and they must have, I have a typo in here, so correct myself. Provides they must demonstrate responsibility by showing that they have actual license with the state in the services they provide, and that the bidder is covered by liability and other insurance in the amounts required in the solicitation documents for a public improvement contract. You do have in front of you a -1 amendment that adds to the qualifications that the bidder must either be a carrier-insured employer or self-insured employer under workers' compensation law, or that they have workers' compensation insurance coverage, and that they have made the required first-tier subcontractor disclosure when they make their bid.
And was that for it? That amendment
was brought forth by the folks that requested the
bill. That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Well, I want to thank you folks for your patience. Mr. Alljets, if you'd want to come up, and Melissa Unger from SEIU. Thanks for your patience. I know, Mr. Alljets, you're not in the building every day, so we've had a wonderful opportunity to sit and watch your government at work.
Yes. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Douglas Alljets. I'm here representing NECA, National Electrical Contractors Association. I'm also president of Kaiser Electric, a local contractor. A few points. We're here in support of this bill. It's not a labor or management bill. Both sides support this bill. Shops that have collecting and bargaining agreements and open shops both support this bill. And to me, it's kind of an obvious thing that needs to be changed. It's a bill that will level the playing field for contractors. With the stimulus money coming into the state and that money that the governor's already appropriated, there's going to be people coming out of the woodwork to take part in these contracts. And if this bill would give the government purchasing and contracting officers the additional language and direction to ensure that those people are licensed, have the proper insurance to cover their employees. So, like I say, we'd encourage you to support this bill, and NECA is really behind this.
Well, you know, it dovetails real nicely into the conversation we're having in this building this year relating to public contracting, accountability, transparency, and analysis of who gets what when they get it, which leads us to Ms. Unger, please.
Well, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Unger, and I am with SEIU Local 503, and I'm here because I saw this bill, and it does dovetail nicely into the previous conversations we've had with your committee around contracting reform. We've had members who came before this committee and talked about how we believe that contractors should be held to the highest standards, just like I think that our members hold themselves to the highest standards in providing public services. And I think the idea that contractors should have the necessary licenses and be covered by liability insurance should be our expectation. And the fact that there's a concern about it means that our laws need to be revised to make sure that that's happening. And during our conversations throughout this whole contracting conversation that we've been having, another piece of the conversation has been how our current responsible bidder guidelines are being enforced now. And as we add to them, you know, we've had a couple of other proposals about how to add to them. How are we making sure that they're being enforced so that we are able to hold these contractors to these standards? And so I think that this is a very important conversation to be having, especially as we see the federal stimulus dollars come into the state and as we continue to make a commitment to taxpayers that we're using their money wisely. I think having these conversations about how contractors are held to these standards is the perfect conversation to be having this session. So thank you for your time, and we support this bill, and look forward to continuing to work on these conversations.
Yeah, I'm just surprised it wasn't already required. It's all this time. It's unbelievable. Representative Thatcher, please.
Representative. Thank you. I didn't have any problem with the bill, but I did have a little bit of a question, and I'm wondering if this was intentional or maybe it's my misinterpretation, but my question is, let me just take projects I know. Road construction. Okay, so you have a road construction project that includes electrical work. Maybe you're going to be installing signals or whatever. Maybe, who knows, plumbing of some sorts for whatever reason. Landscaping, whatever that takes a specialty license. So if this bill, if you read it in the plain language, would that require the general contractor to have licenses in each of those areas, even if they are not perhaps undertaking that work themselves but are actually subbing it out?
Well, through the chair, I believe that the law should, well, the amendment should be added that would include subcontractors. I mean, that now, usually the bonding companies that bond the generals require that their subs are, have these licenses. That I think it should be a part of the law.
If I may, the question is, does the general have to have all the specialty license? And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to say it doesn't say that. But I don't think it does. But we're going to find out, because the answer, do we want to demand that the general have all those licenses, in my opinion, is no. Do we want to demand that the general make sure that all those subcontractors, an electrical contractor, plumbing contractor, landscaping contractor, whoever else,
does have those necessary and required licenses and insurance coverage? Absolutely. But do we want to make, you know, Hoffman become a landscape contractor? No. I think that's what you're getting to,
Exactly. I just didn't...
We'll clarify that. It's a good question. There's a lot of language in here.
Unintended consequences.
And I want to find out about that, too. Definitely we don't want that to happen, because, I mean, some good NECA member could be out there being the general on some job and find out that they have to have a landscaping contract. I don't think we want that to... A contract license. I don't think we want to have that happen. So, any further questions, these good people?
Mr. Chair.
Teresa,
I should point out in the -1 amendment, the Workers' Comp Division did call, because they're, you know, since anything with workers' compensation, there's always a question whether it needs to go in front of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and no, it does not. So
great, thank you.
Point that out.
And would you follow up on Representative Thatcher's question?
Yes.
Please, thank you. All right, unless there's anything else, thanks for coming down. Sorry you had to wait. Melissa's here all day, every day, so I'm not just quite as sympathetic to her as I am, but thanks for coming and being so patient. All right, anyone else want to testify this bill? If not, I'm going to close public hearing House Bill 29538. Anything for the good of the order? Not worth it.